One of the smartest things that they did is at one of the convenings, they asked us to bring examples of student work, right? And so when we brought examples of student work, then we were able to sort of unpack, okay, what do you see in that work? And what would it take for an educator to do to get kids to that product?
This is High Tech High Unboxed. I'm Alec Patton, and that's the voice of Brandon Wiley. Brandon's currently the chief academic officer at Alexander Dawson School at Rainbow Mountain, but that just scratches the surface of where he's been and what he's done. I talked to Brandon at the 2023 Deeper Learning Conference, and we talked about deeper learning because he was there at the beginning, before there was a conference, when a group of schools and other education organizations came together to talk about what it would mean to explicitly focus on cultivating deeper learning for all students. This is a conversation about how Brandon thinks about deeper learning and how to bring it into your school. And it's a conversation about how to take a bunch of organizations that are highly committed to the idea of their own distinctiveness and help them to organize around a shared vision. And because I couldn't help myself, right at the end, we get very forensic on how to set up and run a Socratic seminar. One more thing. Like I said, we were in the middle of the Deeper Learning Conference, so at a few points, Brandon's going to make reference to this event. When he says that, he's always referring to the Deeper Learning Conference, so remember that and you won't get confused. Let's get into it. So take us back. Where does the story begin for you?
For me, the story began in 2010. So I started my tenure as the executive director at the Asia Society. We had an international study schools network. It was a network of, at that time, 35 schools in 8 states, primarily in urban school communities. And the goal of all those schools was to prepare kids to be globally competent and college and career ready. So I worked with all the school leaders in those schools to try to figure out how do we create really cool schools. In many cases, it was an equity, imperative for us that we did this work. And the Hewlett Foundation gave us a call and said, hey, you're part of this national network. Would you like to be part of the conversation about what deeper learning looks like and means in your schools? So I think my first convening was 2010. Cavallo Point, right at the base of the Golden Gate Bridge. They brought these different networks together and really presented this idea of like deeper learning and asked each of us to think about portraying what that would mean or look like in our schools.
So what were your first thoughts when you heard that term?
It seemed ambiguous to me, right? It seemed like this big, broad term. And I think what was interesting is each of the different networks that came had their own school models, right? And so I think in the beginning, frankly, there's a lot of posturing. Each group was sort of promoting their perspective, their way of doing business. There definitely wasn't consensus at that first meeting.
And what was what model were you putting forward at the time?
Yeah, so for us, at the core was project-based learning. I think that's the one thing that all the networks actually had it in common was project-based learning. But how that played out and how they thought about PBL definitely was different. So for us, it was around, again, that global perspective. So all of our projects were centered around globally significant issues with the idea that students would take action, right? So we had our sort of 4 domains of global competence that we talked about, and so we were promoting that as a through line.
Do you remember what some of those early tensions were?
I think there were a lot of conversations, particularly as it relates to PBL, around how much emphasis on process versus product, for example. So we had some of the school networks that I think were a little more product focused, right? And really thinking about that student display presentation of learning piece. And there were others I think were a little more process. I think we were a little in the middle of that.
Yeah. How is one process oriented without being product oriented?
I don't know that you can do one without the other in some way, but I think in some of the approaches, what we've seen is that some schools, I think, are much more deliberate during that process piece, right? So what are those meta moments that students can really be reflective, who can really step out of the project to think about themselves as a learner? And others, it's just sort of like, okay, we're just going to keep marching towards that final presentation. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just a question of like how much scaffold you're providing and how slow or fast to go.
Right, got it. Was there a sense like zero is like, everybody's just kind of like, oh, no, someone said, I heard there'd be food. And 10 is like, this is a movement. We are 100% on this. Where would you say it was that first convening between?
Yeah, definitely not a movement, right? Like it was, as I said, I think there was some posturing in that first convening. They fed us well. We drank well. Like it was a good time. But really, I think for those of us that were leading these networks, part of it was also us feeling each other out for like, where were there some potential synergies? Mm-hmm. I think there were some people in the room who were definitely more interested in figuring out how could our networks work collaboratively. So in most cases, most of these networks were working, again, in large urban communities. So for example, New Tech Network, EL Education, ourselves, like we were in similar districts. And so part of our conversations were like, how are we trying to, you know, bring about change in those environments? So as much as Hewlett brought us together to talk about what is deeper learning, I think we had a side agenda of also figuring out like, how do we try to collaborate to bring forward some kind of different type of learning in some of these environments? So I think that was a byproduct of Hewlett bringing us together. But then we'd always come back to, okay, what is deeper learning? And so then this was the beginning of a series of, I'd say maybe 4 to 5 different convenings where we all came together. And I think one of the smartest things that they did is at one of the convenings, they asked us to bring examples of student work, right? And so when we brought examples of student work, then we were able to sort of unpack, okay, what do you see in that work? And what would it take for an educator to do to get kids to that product? And so that's when we started really teasing out the competencies, was being very grounded in student work. Otherwise, it's sort of stayed at the 30,000 foot view. And I think the student work helped crystallize it.
Do you remember what you brought?
Yeah, we had 3 different performance tasks or sort of mini projects. One was on a sustainable, sort of sustainable energy. Another one was a human rights project. I can't recall what the third one is, but I remember intently having a conversation about like, okay, which work should we bring and what would we be proud of? And we brought a lot of back matter in terms of what the teachers had created. Now, I don't know if all the networks did that. So it was hard sometimes to look at work in absence of what the teachers had done to scaffold it. So you had to make some guesses just by looking at the work.
Yeah. Now, you said that there was some posturing at the beginning. I can imagine that there's a little bit of stress behind, like, everybody's bringing their work.
Right.
How did that feel? Were you worried when you were going in?
Yeah, totally. Because, again, there's a lot of pride, right? You want to be proud of what your schools and the teachers that you work with are producing. But at the same time, once we were able to kind of get past that, it's kind of, I can't put my finger on exactly when that sort of competition and posturing started to dissolve. But I think quickly we realized, oh, we're actually better together. And at the end of the day, if we want these practices, particularly around PBL, around student-led conferences, advisory, like key pieces of our school design models to work, we need to work together to do that.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, do you remember when you were looking at other people's student work, mm-hmm. was there stuff that really changed your thinking or challenged you as far as what you were seeing from other schools?
Yeah, I think in 2 ways. One, like there was definitely some work that blew us away. We're like, oh, wow, like we need to talk about what does quality student work look like and mean and how do we help level that piece up? But then also, again, the groups that did bring some of the back matter, we realized that some of them had created tools to help teachers sort of scaffold their thinking when doing the design work. And I think that's another tension that exists still today, actually, is this idea of teacher as designer versus teacher as sort of implementer or adapter of projects, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and so some networks, I think, had done a better job of creating a bank of projects that teachers could use sort of out of the box and then adapt based on their environment. And then there are others that were very much on the design side and starting from scratch. And those are 2 different lifts, right, in terms of implementation.
Are there any in particular, just you shout people out here, like where you go, wow, they have a really cool bank of projects. People should check that out.
Well, I always shout out EL Education, right? Like at that point, I think they were expeditionary learning. But just the work that they've done to curate student work over the years is really great. I mean, High Tech High and the work that's been done here is another one that I always point to. But those are the 2. I think New Tech's another one. And I think part of it is the networks that have had the longevity, right? They've got a longer runway and they've got a broader network. They've been able to really curate that work better.
Yeah. I want to go back just a little bit here. It kind of seems like the name preceded the content,
yes,
in a way. I don't know, like being like, I've got a title for this movie. I haven't worked out anything else, but I've got a great title. It feels like that was a little bit that here.
Yeah, there is a little bit of that. So I think in those initial convenings, there were some different speakers that they brought in who had been doing some seminal research. So Charles Fidel wrote a book on 21st century skills. So some of his work, Bernie Trilling had worked with him on that. Bernie came and presented to the group. I think they tried to provide us some of the research base. And I think what was interesting about those early convenings is we had the school network folks, we had some researchers who were there to really want to uncover what this looked like and prove it. And then we had funders, right? We had people who actually were interested in trying to promote this type of work. So it was actually a very eclectic group of people in the room. In the beginning, they created a little bit of a framework for us to poke holes in. And then, of course, we brought our ideas to it as well.
Yeah. And did you have a sense of why they were into this?
I think part of it was around just trying to improve student outcomes, right? That learning in so many schools was seen as superficial. It was seen as very rote. And then seeing evidence in these schools about not only how kids were engaging meaningfully, but like how in some cases their outcomes were changing. Most of the kids that were in our network, for example, I would say, close to 85% to 90% of our students were Black and Brown students. Many of them had been in schools that had frankly been underserving them. And so we were definitely trying to change the trajectory of those children, their lives. And so I think that equity piece was woven, throughout all the conversations. In the beginning, probably not very explicitly, and then eventually, I think, much more explicitly.
Yeah. So you're all looking at the student work, and you said at that point you started getting towards the competencies. Was that an explicit plan from the beginning?
I think that was their goal. So Mark Chun was the program officer who was sort of the ringleader bringing us all together. And I think for Mark, I can't speak for him, but my guess is that was a big part of their work was if we can define it and we can codify it in a way that is transferable and scalable. We talked a lot about scalability, right? Not just of the words, but of the practices. And I think that's where the germ of an idea started coming together about, well, let's come together. So after those first initial meetings, again, it was just sort of like the leadership of each of these organizations. We said, well, we probably need to bring teachers together, right? Because if we can bring teachers together and they can start talking about what they do and they can start sharing their practice, then actually this has legs and they can go back to their districts and schools and start doing the work.
What did that look like?
So the first iteration, we had to pay people to come to this, right?
Like and as this I is sit the conference,
right? As I sit here at the Deeper Learning Conference, right? 10 years later, and 1,200 plus people. I'm like, wow, this is awesome. But in the beginning, I literally had to take some of the grant money that we got from the Hewlett Foundation, call up some of my schools and say, hey, we've got this event. Would you come to it? It's at High Tech High. Most everybody knew High Tech High. So that part was the easy part. But I would get a lot of like, well, I don't think we can get substitutes. We can't, I don't know if I can afford to put them on a plane, right? So we paid for a lot of our schools to send people to that initial convening. And I think that might have been before the actual first Deeper Learning Conference, so maybe in 2012. I know the school networks, we each got 5 to 10 people that we could bring. So we all brought them together. We did sessions where they talked about what they're doing in their classrooms. And I think it's at that point that some of us got together and said, hey, it's fine for us to talk about this within our networks, but it's almost like preaching to the choir. How do we broaden it beyond our networks? Because that's where the real work was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I think, how this conference was born.
So at that point, you sort of have two steps. One is, let's have a conference.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one, I think, was let's have some competencies so we have a sense of what this is.
Yeah.
How'd you come up with the competencies?
I think there were some iterations, right, of where we started. I don't remember exactly how many we had at the beginning, but certainly not the 6. There was probably closer to 10.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of nuance within them, things that could be combined, things that needed to be teased out. And then there was always the question about, are these things measurable? Right. So it's one thing to say we should be teaching these things and helping students learn these skills. But then it's like, how would we know? Right. What's the evidence piece? And that's where I think some of the people who are in the room around research were really helpful. The Envision schools were part of that work, and some of the work that Bob Lenz and Justin were doing at Envision was really instrumental to that, because most of the school networks had some form of a portfolio and or defense. And I think those groups that had done a lot of good thinking on that started to help us crystallize, okay, it's one thing to articulate the competencies, but then how can we collect student work that would actually signify that kids had mastered those things.
Were there any controversial ones?
I do remember there was some debate about content knowledge and whether or not, is that central? And if so, how would you call that out?
How do you mean, how would you call that out?
Well, so the question is, is it assumed in all the other competencies that students need deep content knowledge and to be able to apply that content knowledge, in the work? Or does it need to be called out as a separate competency?
Right.
Right. So that's one conversation I recall. We didn't want to recreate the wheel, but also wanted to make sure that we had something that was accessible, right?
Yeah.
That teachers wouldn't look at it and be like, oh crap, this is way too much for me to think about.
Was this process changing how you looked at your own schools your own network?
Yeah, to some extent, I would say it did inform our professional development. So as I think about some of the resources that we created for schools, when the six competencies were sort of decided, we started to retrofit some of the work that we had been doing to make those more explicit and called out in the work that we were doing. So I was the executive director there from 2010 to 2014. So just when this party was getting started at High Tech High with the conference, you know, I was transitioning to another role with an organization called Springpoint, where we're actually designing competency-based high schools, trying to like rethink the high school model. And so I took those competencies and started thinking about how it would apply to that environment. And then eventually I went to the Buck Institute, PBL Works, as their chief program officer. And obviously all the work we've been doing with project-based learning, it feels like for me the last 10 years, wherever I've gone, I've been able to take those competencies and apply it to the work.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. Do you remember when the competencies got solidified?
I don't remember that. It's funny because I was talking to someone else about this. My recollection is that fairly within the first 3 years of us meeting, I believe they were sort of firmed up. And I do think that the first official conference was where sort of the language was released or kind of launched. And then for those of us that were involved in the work, it was a question of like, okay, well, how do we put like workshops together? How do we put materials together to help promote? And the other tension that I do recall was how much do we promote what we do versus how much do we promote what, you know, Hewlett would like us to talk about in terms of deeper learning, right? How do we not subsume ourselves as a network that has a key, you know, identity into what, you know, deeper learning is?
And what was the difference there?
For us, what it was just like drawing connections, right? So we had our collateral that talked about our school design model and the way teaching and learning happened in ISSN schools. But then we would always refer back to, and here's how those practices relate to the deeper learning competencies.
Yeah.
So we never completely adopted them per se or said like, these are the six things, but we always try to make connections to how those things related.
Right.
And I would imagine most networks probably did that. Because I think the other thing to keep in mind is that we all, you know, had a business to run as well. So we were really trying to promote our approach.
That is interesting because in a way, everybody's collaborating, but in a way there's competition too. Maybe not so much because it's like, no parent is like, should I send my kid right. to High Tech High right. or should I move to the Bay and go to Envision? Yeah. Like right. nobody's having
right.
that conversation.
Right. right.
But
right.
there is a certain, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, because the truth is we're all operating in the same ecosystems, right? It's the same districts and the same communities. And those systems will be better if they have more of these progressive, you know, education opportunities. And what happened is there were some really cool projects that emerged from this. So one of the projects that involved New Tech Network, Envision, Connect Ed, and Asia Society was this Deeper Learning Student Assessment Initiative, DLSAI. It was a mouthful. So that was a separate project that evolved where we said, you know, we really still need to bring student work to the center to talk about what this looks like. So we, as networks, got together separately, aside from the conference and aside from everything else, just to talk about, how do we collect student work and be able to have exemplars of what these competencies look like in action. And that was just another way for our networks to come even more close.
One element of all this is like obviously this story. Another element is how any other network or district or organization who's trying to grapple this stuff can do it, what methods they can take from this process. So bringing student work and looking at student work together, you said, was a big mm-hmm. breakthrough moment. I guess paying people to come to a conference yeah. was another
That helps. Yeah, I mean, I think, I'm just trying to think of some of the other themes that we talked about over the years. One of them was around this idea of a portrait of a graduate. That's another big piece that emerged, I think, for a lot of our networks was, how do we articulate what our North Star is? Whether I'm a school leader or a district leader, do we all have a common shared vision of what success looks like? Mm-hmm. And then these practices that these deeper learning practices are in service of getting us to those outcomes. So I think a lot of schools and districts started doing that work. I know Ed Leader 21 was another group that wasn't a school network, but was also part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And so they've been, you know, they historically have led a lot of that portrait of a graduate work. You know, I think what I love about this conference is that there are different practices that I think can lead students to those outcomes. And every year that I've been part of this event, I just love being able to see very concretely how schools and districts are doing the work. And I think if I was new to this work, I would want to think about, okay, do we have a North Star? Do we have a vision for what success looks like? And then what are some of the practices that would help us get there and take stock of what we already do and what more we could do?
So just to connect that up, it's like, the North Star is that Portrait of a Graduate really does that if you're mm-hmm. a school.
Right.
And then as that kind of understanding where we're at, that student work. And I think the point that you bring about, actually that student work works a lot better if you bring the teacher work that created the conditions for that student work.
Exactly.
That's really valuable.
And it's not easy, I will say. Like, Fred, just to be really truthful, I think most schools and districts, like, that's a lot of work, and they don't have the mental muscle and experience of how to do that well. Mm-hmm. And that's something I'm in a school setting now again, and I'm thinking about that of, like, how do we create the structure for teachers to be able to do that in a safe space? Because just like we did as a network, when I brought that work, I was anxious and nervous about what people would think about it. You know, if I were a sixth grade teacher again, I would think that same way. And it takes effort to sort of build that mental muscle of how to come together and look at work.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying it's easy, but I think it's important.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just like exhibition for a
yeah,
kid.
Exactly.
It's not easy,
totally.
But it's important.
Exactly.
I want to go quickly back through. I think you've said it all, but I want to make sure that I've got it. Your trajectory, just professionally, when this process started, where were you?
So when I, in October of 2010 is when I started my tenure at Asia Society. Before that, I was an assistant superintendent in a district just outside of Buffalo, New York. And I just knew I didn't want to be a superintendent. I wanted to do something different. I had this amazing opportunity to move to New York City and, you know, join Asia Society, which interestingly is this like cultural institution. It was founded by John D. Rockefeller III. It's not an education organization. It's a museum on the Upper East Side. But they had this education department within it that had this opportunity through a grant from the Gates Foundation to work with districts. And so it was a big life change. And I think within a month or two of starting the job was when we had this first convening at Cavallo Point. So not only was my job new, this whole community was brand new to me. And I think for me, the advantage was, because it was all new to me, I didn't have any preconceived notions about the work or the people. And so for me, I always felt like I came to the work in a very collaborative nature and not in that competition piece, because it was through that collaboration that I was going to learn and I was going to be able to do my job better. And so that was really awesome.
And so then after Asia Society, where'd you go?
I was there for 4 years. Then I went to an organization called Spring Point, which is another New York-based organization. And they had received a grant, I believe, from the Carnegie Corporation at the time. And the idea there was, you know, high schools don't work. So how do we redefine what the high school experience for students are? And so we work with different school districts around the country to design competency-based high schools. In many cases, those were focused on getting kids out of school and trying to think, you know, go away from seat time as one of the rules and think about what are the competencies that kids need to be able to demonstrate and how do we do that both in and out of school. So that was really fun, and I was involved in probably about half a dozen school designs.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I did a little consulting work on my own. I just needed a break from being in any one organization. And that was really fun because that's another way that I re-engaged with the deeper learning community. And so EL Education, I did a project with them. I ran my own conference called the Global Education Forum. And so that just gave me a chance to, again, experience deeper learning in a different way. And one of my clients was the Buck Institute for Education. And, you know, I was fortunate to join them then full time as a chief program officer. So my 4 years there was really focused on, again, how do we deepen our professional development opportunities for schools. And a lot of the work actually was focused on leader development, because what we noticed was that we can train teachers, we can get them excited, and then they go back into schools and systems that are not conducive for this type of learning. So my bet has really been, and really what I've been focused on in the last probably 5 to 6 years, is how do we build the competencies of school and district leaders so that they can create the conditions that allow deeper learning to happen.
Then you went to the Alexander Dawson School.
Yeah, so now I'm at the Alexander Dawson School as a chief academic officer. And to be honest, it was my pandemic makeover. So my whole family, my mom, my dad, my brother are all living in Vegas. And after 10 years of flying all over the world, I wanted to be in one place and actually do the work, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think in a lot of the roles that I had, I was working in and around schools trying to help people do this work. And it's been awesome this is my third year at the school, really doing the work. So our teachers are, you know, designing and implementing project-based learning. We have student-led conferences. We're trying to really focus on the SEL piece and how we use our advisory program. And so a lot of the things that I've been able to, you know, glean from this community over the last 10 to 13 years, it's really fun to be in a place to do it.
All right. I want to finish up with a lightning round.
Sure.
Here.
Okay.
We're going to go through your history of places you worked.
Okay.
I want to know, what is something that place is doing really well that everybody else in the deeper learning network and beyond would really benefit from getting? What do they have to offer? So Asia Society to start.
I think the global perspective, right? This idea that we can learn with and from the world, right? I think we have been a very US-centric sort of perspective, and there's a lot of things happening in other countries that we should capitalize on.
Right on.
And just seeing a lot of global participants this year. I had Vietnam, Japan, Mexico, like I've already. So that part is starting to happen here.
Yeah. All right. Spring Point. Is that the right?
Yep. I think that one is around like, how do we just break out of our mental models of how school happens? Right? Like we have to be bold and think differently about what we do with kids.
How do we break out of our mental models?
I mean, it's hard, man. Like part of it is we have to get people in positions of authority who can think differently. Mm-hmm. Right, we need to have the decision makers think differently about what school should be.
Yeah. All right, now you do a little bit with EL, so let's...
It's just about like the beauty of work and the work, you know, Ron Berger's work around craftsmanship. Like we're continually as a school talking and looking at their work about how do we help give kids feedback to make their work beautiful and make a difference in the world.
Yeah.
For PBL Works, one of my takeaways there, again, is just around really well designed and thought through professional development will change people's mindsets and practices. And so I'm really proud of the work that team, you know, continues to do to really bring people together. They've done some amazing work around leader networks. Mm-hmm. Right now they're doing a lot of work in Kentucky and thinking about like, how do we change the system? So the people working in the system, like we're just getting rid of the barriers.
There are like approximately a billion services that provide professional learning to teachers. Mm-hmm. What does PBL Works do really well?
One of the things that we try to do or have tried to do is really make complex ideas accessible to people in ways and also give them tangible things that they can do right away. So much of the professional learning is around modeling best practice, about giving you strategies, so you understand the why, but then you also can go and replicate that in your classroom. And I think for myself, because I also, in addition to being an administrator, I teach a seventh grade class called Global Leadership, and I'm constantly pulling on strategies and ideas from the trainings that I've been a part of and trying it with my kids.
Yeah. And then Alexander Dawson School, what should we learn from you all?
I think that's to be determined. You know, we're on the ascend right now. Like we're doing some really good things. It's a 23-year young school that sometimes still feels like a startup. I think the power of our community, you know, in particular, we had a unique opportunity during the pandemic to stay open that first year when most schools were closed. We're one of the few, and it's just part of who the school is as an independent school. We were able to do that. And so I think that just bonded us as a community. And now that we're doing this work, I think those relationships are paying dividends.
Mm-hmm. Having done all this and come back to the classroom, leave us with like a killer go-to teacher move strategy that you rely on.
I don't know if this is a teacher move so much as I'm just trying to decenter what happens in the classroom off of me and more on the kids, right? And so how do I create opportunities for kids to talk, to write, to you know, to communicate? So in our class, in this global leadership class, what we're focused on is what are the qualities, the mindsets, the dispositions of effective leaders? And we don't point to any one person and say effective, ineffective. We're just saying like, how do people show up in ways that help move things forward and make a difference, and then get kids to reflect on who they are as leaders. And so we do a lot with Socratic Seminar. I'm a big believer in getting kids out and interviewing and talking to people in the world doing really cool stuff.
Okay, so let me ask, Socratic Seminar, what number of kids do you prefer?
In that class, the sweet spot there is we have 14 kids.
You have 14 kids in the class total.
That's right. This is, I think, unique to Dawson, is in 6th and 7th grade, we have these quarter-long classes called Insight classes. Mm-hmm. And we designed them that each class focuses on different competencies that kids would need in 8th grade when they do their 8th grade capstone project, where they partner with a community nonprofit, and they're exploring an issue and trying to figure out how they can impact that issue. And so each of our classes, we've been very mindful of saying like, so in my class, it's around your interview skills, your public speaking skills, your writing and research skills, and the different tasks that we've created in those classes. And it's every quarter, you know, they take a different class. I get a new group of kids. And, you know, again, we're trying to prepare them for that 8th grade.
Yeah. All right. I got a couple more Socratic Seminar questions for you. Do you ground them on a single reading?
Typically, yes. Like most, just this last week, we did one. It was an article talking about, you know, 20 different leadership characteristics that leaders have, and they had to be discerning about which ones they thought were most important and hardest to learn. Those were the two prompts that I gave them for that article.
All right. Do you grade on participation?
It's a tricky one, right? Like my question, my thing is like every class I'm trying to create structures where every student has an opportunity to engage in some way. I have like three kids I can think of right now that if their life depended on it, they would rather not speak in class. Mm-hmm. So I have to find other ways to see them engaged because they're not going to raise their hand for me. So there's not a participation grade per se, but I'm always like mindful of like who's engaged and who's not.
Yeah.
And then, 'cause I was that kid. In middle school, I would not, I know it's hard to believe, I got a lot to say, but I would never have raised my hand. I was sort of that wallflower that the teacher called on me, I would have died. So I empathize with that kid.
And then how do you come up with an essential question for, or do you use this, do you come up with a teacher-driven essential question?
This has been one of my harder things as a teacher, is thinking about what is a really compelling question that I can, because when I've seen them done really well, I have one teacher in particular who will use an essential question at the beginning of a unit or a project, post that question, and is actually really intentional every class to come back and say, what did we do today that is helping you get closer to answering that question? I will be honest in saying I'm not that good at it as compared to her. Because I teach the class every quarter, I have to be honest in also saying that I think my question has probably changed like three times this year, right? Just tweaking it and getting it just right.
But do you come in, do you do a question, an individual question to ground an individual seminar?
Not usually. Usually I tie it back to what the overarching question or questions are for the entire project or
unit. So it's like, we all know this question. We've just got, we've had a new input from this reading.
Correct.
How does that apply to the question?
Correct.
Got it.
So there's typically, I will use a question or a prompt to get the conversation going, but it's, I wouldn't call it an essential question probably.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And those are my favorite classes because then I just kind of sit back and, you know, listen in and we'll interject occasionally. But it's not easy. Like, I don't think many of our students are used to doing that. They're getting better. And as the quarter goes on, I can notice that, you know, they're more comfortable having those discussions.
Yeah.
Because they're really, in many cases, kids have been acculturated to want the teacher to just give them the answer or to lead the discussion or interject. And we have to, like, break them of that.
Yeah.
Or just not teach them that in the first place, right?
Awesome. All right. Is there anything else I should have asked you that I didn't?
No, I mean, I just think for me, as I reflect on this event in particular and this community, I think for me the greatest value has been just the networking, right? I was explaining to my teachers today, like, the workshops will be awesome. Soak it up. The artifacts and the examples of student work in these buildings, the high-tech high buildings, take a lot of pictures, get a lot of ideas, but most importantly, make a couple new friends. Mm-hmm. Because I think for me, all those different things I've done in my career, in part, has allowed me to just meet really awesome people who push my thinking. And, you know, I ran into Ben Daly, you know, this morning from High Tech High. And just like, when I think of the conversations he and I have had over the years, and some of the other leaders from these networks, that's what has sustained me as a professional and frankly, like, pushed me to want to do more and be more. And I think for most teachers that engage in this work, it's lonely work sometimes, and it's good to have friends.
Yeah. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure getting to know you today.
Thank you.
So thank
Appreciate
you so much.
It. Thanks.
High Tech High Unboxed is hosted and edited by me, Alec Patton. Our theme music is by Brother Herschel. We've got a link to the Deeper Learning Hub's website in our show notes. Thanks for listening.